And we return. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman. Bonnie, it's the first day of our pledge drive, so we hope our listeners will support.
Will step up and support.
Support you and I and Topical Currents and our great crew.
And local programming.
And give us a call at 1-866-247-9576. You can also go online at WLRNradio.org and pledge the easy way. We hope you'll support our regional and local programming, for it gives WLRN a South Florida flavor. Speaking of Florida, today we visit with columnist, author, and Columbia University journalism professor Samuel Friedman. He's written the book Breaking the Line, The Season in Black College Football That Transformed the Sport and Changed the Course of Civil Rights. Welcome to you, Samuel Friedman. Good to see you.
Thanks very much. So glad to be with both of you.
Thank you so much for joining us, Professor. So, you know, I think most of us know about baseball, Jackie Robinson, when we think of breaking the color line in sports. But college football is not something we usually associate with the civil rights movement. I knew nothing about it before reading your book. What initiated your interest in their intersection?
Well, one simple reason is that I'm a lifelong football fan, and this is my seventh book, and I'd always told myself I'd write at least one book about football, but I always wanted it to be about something other than football itself, football plus, and the question was, plus what? And I was thinking about football and race, football and civil rights, and once I was focused on that, it brought me to the world of the HBCUs, the historically black colleges and universities. Because that's where you had both tremendous civil rights movement activity. You know, leaders like John Lewis and Jesse Jackson and Diane Nash came out of black colleges. And it's where you also had this incredible high level of college football taking place, little noticed because it was in the era of segregation and these teams were hardly being covered, except, I should say, by certain pro-civil rights newspapers like the Miami Herald. And then I just was wondering, where do these lines cross? Is there a way in which the football story and the civil rights story become one? And I did find it in the 1967 football season at Grambling and Florida A&M. And the other thing I found out that I hadn't totally grasped at the outset is that college football was an important pillar of segregation. That in the South, if you go back in the day into the 50s and 60s, there are no pro football franchises now down here. There's no Major League Baseball south of St. Louis or Washington. So college football was the regnant sport of this region of the country, and that schools like Alabama and Georgia and LSU kept their football teams segregated for almost a decade after their student bodies. It was such an important sport that they wanted to prove they could keep winning with all white teams. And as a result of that, to desegregate it was going to have an impact way beyond football itself.
And yet black collegiate players were playing in the NFL before they could play in big-time white colleges.
That's exactly right. You know, Eddie Robinson, who's the coach at Grambling, who I write about in the book, sent the first black player to the modern NFL, a running back named Tank Younger, in 1948. And the pro scouts, whose business it was to find talented players, knew how to find their ways to schools like Grambling and FAMU and Tennessee State and Southern.
To the HBCUs.
But it didn't change the regional and legal resistance to desegregating college teams. And let's face it, also in the NFL itself, and by the way, in colleges in the North, blacks still couldn't be coaches and blacks still couldn't play quarterback. So you have the situation in which Jackie Robinson desegregates pro baseball in 1947. There's not a regular starting black quarterback in the NFL until the mid-1970s, when James Harris, who I write about in the book, does it. And the reason is that being a quarterback meant defying and toppling some of the worst, most noxious stereotypes about black Americans. The idea that a black wasn't smart, well, being a quarterback is a very cerebral position. The idea that blacks are supposed to take orders, but the quarterback gives orders. The idea that blacks are talented in an animalistic way, they're the quote-unquote natural athlete, but to have the strength of character, the aplomb, the grace under pressure, they can't have that.
Sort of like that Jimmy the Greek stereotype stuff.
Exactly. And, you know, I still, you know, watch sports talk shows, and occasionally to this day, we'll hear a terrific black quarterback like Russell Wilson of the Seahawks described as a natural athlete. This guy is 5'9" or 5'10" and 180. He's a great quarterback because of what he's got above his shoulders.
Not because he's a natural athlete.
At that height and weight,
I'd like to go back, if we can, to 1967, the year you write about, a pivotal year. Where were we, if you could just set the scene for us, where we were as a country regarding civil rights and the role of the Southern black colleges playing in the movement? You mentioned a few of the people that had come from them, but if you could just set the scene for us.
Thanks for asking me to do that. 1967 is kind of a pivotal year for which way race relations are going to go in this country, because you've seen some of the progress come to fruition. Thurgood Marshall is appointed to the Supreme Court. You have a crossover film star like Sidney Poitier. Bill Cosby's on TV. The first black mayors are being elected in cities like Gary and Cleveland. And I think here in Miami, I believe it's the year Althea Range gets elected the first African-American to be on the Board of Commissioners. And on the other hand, we're coming out of the long, hot summer of urban riots and a tremendous frustration with the slow pace of change. And the key thing here in the South is that it's 13 years past Brown versus Board of Ed, when segregation was supposedly made unconstitutional, and yet segregation still persists in most of the South, including in college football.
And so I'm sorry, go ahead, Joe.
Is it true? It seems like I read that actually the University of Florida didn't integrate their football team. They did it after the University of Alabama, actually.
It's possible.
1969. University of Miami, 1968, was their first black player.
Right. Alabama was actually 1971, their first black player on the field. In 1969, Bear Bryant at Alabama.
Okay, so I'll take back
that's that okay.
From our Gator fans.
Right. But Bear Bryant was actually being sued by a black civil rights lawyer in Alabama over not recruiting black players as of 1969.
And he was being sued in 1969?
Yes.
And so now they were reluctantly accepting black students, sometimes with the force of law behind them, but they wouldn't integrate the football teams?
Exactly. There was still a view that you could be a number one team or go to the top bowl games or be in the top 10 without having the terrible thing, quote unquote, of black players. Hmm. And so the effect of these great black football programs was ultimately to force the change, to show sometimes in direct competition, like the first interracial college game in the South, which I write about in the book, to show that black teams could beat white teams, to show that a black coach could outcoach a white coach. But it took that kind of on-the-field proof of it before the change occurred.
What kind of effect did the 1966 all-black Texas Western beating Kentucky of all teams in the NCAA basketball final?
It's a great parallel. All-black Texas Western, now UTEP as it's called, beats all-white Kentucky for the NCAA basketball title. That matters, I think, in some of the states, certainly in pro basketball it matters. It matters in states like Kentucky and North Carolina in the South that had big, big basketball fan cultures, fan bases. But college basketball for most of the South didn't hold a candle to college football in terms of the following, the passion, and the cultural importance. So what happens in 66 in the basketball tournament really doesn't affect college football down here at all.
So you're saying, in spite of integration, in spite of legislation, the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act, there was still this sense of white supremacy?
On the football field, for sure. You know, there's a line in Alabama's fight song that I think is sadly revealing, and it says, "Your Dixie's football pride, crimson tide." Mm. And I think that's a coded way of saying, you know, that we can win by being all white. And what was so valiant about what the black college teams did was, with far smaller budgets, far poorer facilities, no media attention to speak of outside of the African-American media, was that they could operate at this surpassingly high level of football, and also, by the way, have these incredible graduation rates for their student athletes, who were all imbued with this idea that your football scholarship is your way to get your college diploma. If you go into the pros, that's great, but that's not the point.
We're speaking with Samuel Friedman. We're talking about breaking the line. We're going to take a break. We'll be coming back with more.
And welcome back to today's Topical Currents. Thanks so much for your support of regional and local programming. Bonnie Berman here with Joseph Cooper. We're visiting with Samuel Friedman. He's an award-winning author, New York Times columnist, and Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism professor. The name of his latest book is Breaking the Line, The Season in Black College Football That Transformed the Sport and Changed the Course of Civil Rights. Professor, I want to get to the coaches because that's a pretty amazing story. You take these two black college football teams, the Louisiana Grambling Tigers, coached by Eddie Robinson, and Florida A&M Rattlers, coached by Jake Gaither. So tell us a little about them.
These are two of the greatest football coaches in history. Just statistically speaking, Eddie Robinson to this day is the winningest coach in major college football. And Jake Gaither ended up with a winning percentage of about 85%, one of the best in football history. And they both sent scores of players to the pros. They're a fascinating study in contrast in coaching styles, though. Jake Gaither is an incredible innovator. He devises, you know, an offense that is still being utilized by pro and college teams today. He recruits for speed at every position. He doesn't want heavy players in the line. He wants team speed, which has become a standard thing in football, in the pros, and in strong conferences.
I think the quote was agile, mobile, and hostile.
Right, agile, mobile, and hostile. He has three full units, which he calls blood, sweat, and tears, taking Winston Churchill's phrase. So he's substituting often during a game to just wear out the other team. And he's a great delegator of responsibility. It's interesting. It's partly making lemonade out of lemons, because when Jake Gaither was a relatively young man, he had a malignant brain tumor, and his life was saved actually by a white surgeon who did an operation in a normally all-white hospital to save Jake Gaither's life. But he
In Florida?
In Tennessee, in Nashville, at Vanderbilt Hospital.
Oh, okay.
He had to travel with Jake Gaither all the way up in a car from Tallahassee to Nashville for that operation. But Jake Gaither didn't have some of the energy and stamina to be, you know, a micromanager. So he hired great assistant coaches and really trusted them. He would say, I don't want a ditto man. I want someone who will disagree with me. And by the way, an incredible erudite bunch of people. Jake Gaither had a master's degree and had done post-master study at Yale. Every coach on his staff in 1967 had a master's degree. And most of them had gotten them at these research universities in the North, because the Southern schools still wouldn't allow black grad students there. And then Eddie Robinson is very much the micromanager. He's like a Vince Lombardi type of coach. He's about having a very small number of plays that Grambling can execute flawlessly, and also about great physical intimidation on his offensive and defensive lines. But the quintessence of Eddie Robinson, it was a story his quarterback, James Harris, told me. They're playing a game against Alcorn A&M, and Harris goes to the line, and someone on Alcorn's defense starts calling out, they're going to run the 126 counter, they're going to run the 126, which is one of those dozen or so plays that Grambling always uses. So Harris calls timeout, goes over to the sideline, and goes to Eddie Robinson, says, Coach, they know the play. What should I call? And Eddie Robinson says, the 126. So Harris goes back and calls the same play, and it goes for a touchdown. And as he goes off the field after the touchdown, Robinson says, it's all about blocking and tackling, which was his way of saying it's all about
execution.
It's
sort of a form
execution.
Of the old Green Bay power sweep. You know it's coming, but you can't stop it.
It's exactly. And Lombardi was a model. Grambling's helmets used the same G logo, the same typeface as the Green Bay helmets of that era did. And Eddie Robinson did want to coach every position. He had great assistants, but if you saw him at practice, he'd be going from position group to position group to position group, you know, showing how to tackle better, how to throw a better pass, how to block against the blocking side better. And the joke about Grambling is that their kicking game was weak because that was the one position he didn't have time to coach during every practice.
Now, here they were, these incredible coaches. Did Robinson and Gaither see themselves as figures in the civil rights movement, or did they just feel they're doing their jobs?
You know, they had a really interesting two-level attitude about it. These were men who grew up in an era when segregation seemed permanent to them. They had taken their first coaching jobs in the wake of lynchings, right, in or near each college town that they went to. They had had segregation pervade everything in sports. They couldn't go to coaching clinics. They couldn't attend games as young men. And so for a long time, their approach to civil rights was indirect, that they could be role models of dignified black citizenship, that they would train their players to get their degrees, to be church-going young men, to be walking, talking examples of the black case for equality. But by the time we're into the 60s, they're coming under criticism, which I think we have to say is deserved, for not being out there in a more public way. And the amazing thing that happens in 1967 is they each move from indirect gradualism to very direct ways of contributing to the movement. Eddie Robinson, that's the year that he really breaks out James Harris as the person who'll be the Jackie Robinson of pro football, the first black quarterback to stick in the NFL. And Jake Gaither, during the 67 season, is using all this political goodwill he'd built up with the political class in Tallahassee, you know, all of whom are white, of course, all the elected officials, all the appointed regents, and he's using that to get permission to play the first ever interracial college football game in the South. That is played 2 years later, Tampa against Florida A&M. And it's not just that Florida A&M wins the game, it's that that becomes the largest act of massive public desegregation in the South. 45,000 people in Tampa Stadium, a municipal stadium, massive desegregation of a public facility. And that had been Jake Gaither's lifetime goal, was to create that game.
Now, how did he get approval for that?
He had, partly by not being outspoken on civil rights, accumulated a lot of clout with governors and legislators and regents. So some of it is that he'd been saving it up and saving it up all these years. And some of it is that he was a very astute student of politics. He was someone who knew history well, and he could see a few of the younger appointees to the Board of Regents who were a little bit more reachable on civil rights, whether they were liberal or whether they're concerned about the future of Florida's tourist industry if the state didn't move forward. And he was able to kind of really leverage them to get this approval. But the thing I'll add is that it was still so controversial that the Board of Regents didn't leave a written record of it. The deal they offered Jake Gaither was, we'll say yes verbally, but there'll be no proof that we ever allowed this game to happen.
They didn't want it in writing.
Exactly.
Now, this 1967 Florida A&M Grambling Orange Bowl Classic in the Miami Orange Bowl, why was it so important, and was there TV and radio involved?
Yeah, the Orange Blossom Classic was like the Super Bowl for black college football. Again, younger listeners have to imagine back to an era when black schools couldn't play in bowl games. They couldn't play against white teams. They couldn't play in the small college tournaments. So they had to create their own championship game, which was the Orange Blossom Classic. And by the way, for the heyday of that in the 40s through the late 60s and early 70s in Miami, that was the largest annual gathering of African Americans for any reason in this country, bigger than a church convention, bigger than the NAACP convention, bigger than anything. It was a week-long celebration. And the importance of 67, first of all, on the field, it's one of the rare times Grambling and Florida A&M and Eddie Robinson and Jake Gaither go head-to-head. Secondly, it's a breakthrough year because it's the first time black college football gets on TV. It's on tape delay, but nonetheless, that game that year gets shown in Atlanta, Philly, D.C. and New York, and it anticipates the fact that the following fall, Grambling gets to play a game in Yankee Stadium, which is a huge expansion in the knowledge about black college football, at least among white football fans. And it's also a year when you have an enormous number of pro scouts at the Orange Blossom Classic, and they're watching James Harris play quarterback. So you have this whole experiment of, can we create a black quarterback who the NFL will accept? And James Harris plays an MVP game in that game in front of about 25 pro scouts. So at all those levels, it's immensely important.
Well, we're going to get back to the quarterbacks because that's another story. We're speaking with Samuel Friedman. He's an author, New York Times columnist, Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism professor, and the author of Breaking the Line. And we'll take that short break. And please support WLRN's Topical Currents, and we'll be right back.
And we return. We certainly want to thank those listeners who have made their pledge and supported Topical Currents. Well, we continue our conversation with Samuel Friedman. We're talking about his book, Breaking the Line, which documents the important 1967 Orange Blossom Classic, which, of course, was played here in Miami. Florida A&M against Grambling. So how did it turn out?
I probably shouldn't give a spoiler.
That's right.
But I'll say it came down to the last play, and I'll say that it's a great college football game, a game that people ought to think about in the company of the 1966 Notre Dame-Michigan State game and 1971 Nebraska-Oklahoma and some of these other real
1983 Miami-Nebraska?
Yes, I remember watching that one on TV, right? 31-30, am I remembering mm-hmm. that right?
Yeah.
Wow, you two are amazing.
Fumble Ruskies.
Now, can you see that game? Can you go back in the archives and can this be seen by anybody?
Well, you know, one of the consequences, first of all, of no ESPN, much tighter NCAA control over what games could be broadcast, is that much less football, period, was broadcast at that time. I did find some film of this game in the Louisiana State Archives, and there's a video archive here in Miami that had some highlights that were shown on one of the Miami TV stations.
Probably the Wolfson.
The Wolfson, yes. Yeah. And they had highlights that were shown probably on the 10 o'clock news
okay.
the night the game was played, because it was all from the first half.
Okay, so now I want to get to the quarterbacks. And I'd like to start with James Harris at Grambling. First, I heard you in an interview say that he was very reluctant to speak with you. It took a long time to get that interview. Why was that?
Well, James Harris lived a lot of his career in the midst of controversy. You know, imagine being the first black quarterback to go into the NFL.
And a big controversy in Pittsburgh.
Well, no, that was different. That was Joe Gilliam. But what happened is that black quarterbacks who made it to the pros would be forced to change positions. They'd sometimes be able to play a couple of games and get off to a good start, which is what happened to Joe Gilliam, Pittsburgh, and Marlon Briscoe at Denver, and then abruptly, boom, they're benched or they're changed positions. James Harris and Eddie Robinson, his coach, put the message out when he went to the pros, he will not change positions. And so when he played, he was under an incredible double pressure.
Oh, yeah.
One pressure is the pressure you might expect, which is the race hate. And I've sat down with James Harrison, looked at the hate mail. He got these letters with nooses and watermelons and the most vile language. He played one game at the LA Rams under a death threat so severe that there were armed guards outside his hotel room the night before the game and armed guards on the LA Rams sideline during the game. So imagine trying to perform at a pro level with that. But then the other pressure he had is a positive pressure of black America looking at him the way it had once looked at Jackie Robinson and feeling like, you've got to make it. If you don't make it, it's going to impede the progress for all of us. So he's bearing both of those burdens. And after 3 great years with the Rams, when they tried to replace him, it became a national issue. It was a city council resolution about it in L.A. on Richard Pryor's variety show. He did a skit about it. This was something so well known you could make a joke on national TV and know the audience would get it. And so I think that made him very cautious about how much do I want to revisit all of this in an interview process. But what people have told me about James Harris is that he takes his time making a decision, but once he makes it, he's so perceptive, he's so deep, it'll be worth the wait. And I found that to absolutely be the case. It was totally worth waiting a year and a half for the first interview with him, because he opened many other doors and because he was just a remarkably thoughtful and eloquent person who, in a way that's not self-aggrandizing, really understood where his experience fit into the civil rights narrative in this country.
I'm wondering, you said he got some hate mail and all that. I'm wondering how was he received by the management of the Rams and by the other players?
Well, that's such a great question. He was really supported by his coach, Chuck Knox, who was a white man. Chuck Knox gave James Harris the starting position when, remember, there had never been a regular starting black quarterback in the NFL, and his teammates voted him captain. So he was extremely, extremely esteemed by his coach and his teammates. The Rams ownership, though, overruled the coach and brought in 4 white quarterbacks in a row to try to take his job.
Was that Rosenblum?
Yes, Carol Rosenbloom, and I can't remember if the GM was Don Klosterman at that time or not, but the front office and the owners brought in Joe Namath, Vince Ferragamo, Pat Hayden.
Namath with the knees that were shot.
Right, exactly. They were shot. And Ron Jaworski. Anyone, it's like, please, someone beat out this black quarterback, and none of them could beat him out. So then they traded James Harris away to the Chargers. But, you know, he had these 3 years in the mid-70s when he took him to the NFC Championship game twice. He led the league in passing, or the conference in passing efficiency twice. He was the Pro Bowl MVP. He was the team captain. And those years transformed the attitude about black quarterbacks in pro football. The year James Harris is traded away to San Diego to end his playing career as a backup, another Grambling quarterback, Doug Williams, is taken in the first round of the NFL draft. And he then, 10 years later, wins the Super Bowl and a Super Bowl MVP. So you can draw this absolutely straight line from James Harris to every black quarterback who came afterwards and to all the ones who are starting this year.
Concerning Florida A&M around this era, tell us about the only man to have won an Olympic gold and also won a Super Bowl.
Bob Hayes.
Mm-hmm. The Bullet.
The Bullet, Florida A&M's great wide receiver and running back. And this, you know, they had so much team speed on Florida A&M that people up there tell me about the fact that when Bob Hayes started there, he wasn't the fastest guy on the team.
Oh, wow.
They had other people.
Later called the fastest human on earth.
Exactly. Right. Well, actually, the defensive coach at Florida A&M, really, really brilliant defensive strategist named Pete Griffin, was also the track and field coach. And he got a lot of the credit, including from Bob Hayes, for adjusting his running style in ways that gave him those tenths of seconds, you know, improvement that make the difference between being, you know, a good NCAA runner and being an Olympic medalist. But I'll tell you another great Bob Hayes story. When Grambling and Florida A&M played in the Orange Blossom Classic in 1964, Hayes was on the team. And he catches this pass and goes for a touchdown against Grambling, who had a great safety later in the pros named Goldie Sellers. Goldie Sellers comes trudging off the field, and Eddie Robinson goes up to him and says, "How come you didn't catch him?" And Goldie Sellers says, "Coach, they couldn't catch him in Tokyo, and I couldn't do it here."
Getting that, you know what surprises me? Everybody knows the name Jackie Robinson. I mean, almost everybody knows that name. Why do we not know the name James Harris?
It's a great, sad question. I think one reason is Jackie Robinson played his whole career for one team. And he remained a starter and an all-star throughout much of his career. James Harris, first of all, there had been other black players at other positions. So he wasn't clearly the first African-American, period. Though he was the first.
Well, of course, Joe Louis had such clout.
Well, right, and
literally.
Joe Louis and Jesse Owens are. But
right.
In football, there had been other black players before James Harris, though never a black quarterback to stick. But his career,
okay.
He was on three different teams. He lost some time to injuries. And when he really was in position with the Rams, when he should have been able to have 6, 7, 8 years steadily as their starting quarterback, that was when their management, for reasons we can only surmise, decided to get rid of him. And it's also because James Harris is a soft-spoken, in terms of his public life, don't call attention to yourself type of person. In the athletic setting, he's got a leadership personality. He's a leader of people. But in terms of dealing with the media, he doesn't like to be out there front and center.
He wasn't a Deion Sanders.
He's the non-Deion Sanders. And as a result, his historical recognition has been slow in coming. I think one of my highest hopes for breaking the line is that this book will help to ensure his place
in history. You know, we have to go. In 30 seconds, where do we stand today in terms of black managers, coaches, and professional football and college football?
The NCAA has been the NFL has been a positive story. This year there are as many in any given week as 8 or 9 starting black quarterbacks. There have been many black head coaches, black general managers like Ozzie Newsome of the Ravens. The NCAA, on the other hand, has really lagged. About half the players at the BCS colleges are African American, and only 10% of the head coaches are African American. So I think that's where some of the work remains to be done.
Well, it's been a real interesting and enlightening book and time spent with Samuel Friedman, an award-winning author, New York Times columnist, Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism professor. We thank you so much for joining us to discuss your book, Breaking the Line, The Season in Black College Football That Transformed the Sport and Changed the Course of Civil Rights.
And thanks for listening. A big thanks as well to those who pledged this hour. 1-866-247-9576 or pledge online at WLRNradio.org. Please support the regional and local programming on WLRN. We add a South Florida flavor to your radio menu. Again, 1-866-247-9576. And now, the calendar for December 9th. On this day in 1911, 102 years ago, the birth of tough guy actor Broderick Crawford in Philadelphia. He won a Best Actor Oscar for 1949's All the King's Men and played Chief Dan Matthews on TV's Highway Patrol. 10-4. And on this day in 1942, 71 years ago, the birth of Football Hall of Famer and actor Dick Butkus in Chicago. He played his entire 8-year career with the Bears. One more while we recall Candle in the Wind. On this day in 1992, 21 years ago, it's announced that Prince and Princess of Wales had officially separated. Divorce came in 1996. Please make that pledge. So we leave with a thought from Broderick Crawford, who played Lenny in Of Mice and Men on Broadway. Quote, "My trademarks are a hoarse grating voice in the face of a retired pugilist, puffy features which looks as though they might have years ago lost on points." So make that pledge, 1-866-247-9576 or WLRNradio.org. This is Joseph Cooper with Bonnie Berman. Stay tuned next for Here and Now from NPR News.